It's always the guys that you'd least expect it that tell you what you need to hear. We went out one night and it was a meeting that they took us out of the rehab for. And I was beating myself up about having 5 years and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, it was the driver of the van. He pulls me in the front seat. He goes, he gives me a cigarette and he lights my cigarette for me. He goes, I heard your share in the meeting and you didn't lose your sobriety. You just changed the date. And that's what I needed to hear.
You're listening to Real Recovery Talk with your host, Tom Conrad. Every day, Tom helps guide people like you who have loved ones dealing with addiction. You're most likely frustrated with the situation, worried your loved one won't get better, and concerned you're not doing enough to help. This show will help you understand the tremendous struggle of addiction from your loved one's perspective. You'll hear stories of recovery, which will give you hope. And you'll understand the limits to what you can and can't do to help those you love. Tom is a certified addictions counselor who's successfully winning his own battle with drug addiction and alcoholism and has helped many others win theirs as well. It's time now for Real Recovery Talk.
Here we are, Real Recovery Talk. I am your host, Tom Conrad. In today's episode, we have Benjamin B. finally decides to make an appearance, or a audio appearance, since you can't see us. Ben was out last episode for some reason. I don't know if it was medical or maybe his wife didn't let him out of the house. I'm not quite sure, but he is here with us today. Benjamin, how are you doing?
I'm doing good, man. Probably a combination of both. I'm always in trouble with the wife.
What was it? Why weren't you with us for the last episode?
Had a CAT scan of my aortic valve. I got some heart issues going on. So,
oh, no.
Yeah.
All right.
You know what's funny about that, though? Sitting in the hospital a couple weeks ago, I used to sit in there just thinking about pain pills. How can I get some pain pills? This time, I'm in there overnight. Doesn't even cross my mind. Just throwing it out there.
All right. Well, that is good. Glad you're here with us. And then we also have a guest, Sean B. Sean B. works for the Haven Detox. It's a detox local here in South Florida. And he's volunteered to come on and share his story about how he was came into addiction and kind of his life story, but also to give some valuable input for those of you that are seeking detox, the proper things to look for, what the detox process is like, so on and so forth. But first, before we get into that, go to realrecoverytalk.com. There you will find every single episode that we have ever released. I think this is episode 157, so there's quite a few to choose from. Scan the topics. For each episode, you could see what, you know, we put a title in there and try and put in there what the episode is going to revolve around. But there's also a description, so make sure to read that description. If it appeals to you or your loved one, by all means, take a listen. And in the end, if you feel like you need help with your situation or a loved one's situation, you could always reach out to us at our emails, tom@realrecoverytalk.com. And
Ben@realrecoverytalk.com.
All right, here we go. Sean, how you doing? Thanks for coming on today.
I'm doing good. Thank you for having me. This is a lovely place you have here.
Yeah, appreciate it. We're all properly socially distanced, you know, so no COVID risks here. Sean brought us some two boxes of Jupiter Donuts. Shameless plug for Jupiter Donuts. If you're ever in South Florida, don't forget to visit Jupiter Donuts to get your sugar fix. I wonder if we'll get any royalties from that. Probably not. Here we go. Sean, so I think in this episode, we want to first talk about you, what it was for you growing up. We like to do this, at least get like some sort of snapshot of your childhood. You know, when did addiction really start becoming a part of your life? Maybe not even inherently starting using, but when did you start seeing addictive behaviors with yourself or your parents or your siblings or whatever the case is? So let's start back when you were a kid, how, you know, where you grew up, what your childhood was like, so on and so forth.
So when I was little, I was born in the Bronx, and my mother and father separated. I moved to Brooklyn with my mother, And it was a really bad time in New York. I grew up in Brooklyn in the 80s. It was a lot of drugs and violence. I saw a lot of things as a kid that probably a lot of kids shouldn't see. Even if you go back a little bit before that, you know, with my mother and father, it was a really unstable household. I saw a lot of drugs and alcohol and violence. And, you know, I'm proud to say today my father isn't the same man he used to be. He actually led by example and actually has well over 30 years of sobriety. And he's always been at me to get this. So, you know, it comes full circle. You know, as a kid, what I saw probably you shouldn't see as a kid. I started to develop addictive behaviors, trying to get out of myself. I saw when I was 13, 12, around there, I started getting a lot of trouble. And Brooklyn was, at that time, New York wasn't a good place. A lot of kids were losing their lives in my neighborhood. They were a lot of families were falling victim to drugs and alcohol. I saw a lot of households destroyed, literally. That was when crack had first came out. And I rarely went to school in the eighth grade. And my mother found out about that. And then when I started to really get in trouble and like run hard in the neighborhood, my mother decided to take me out of there. And I came down to Florida. Everywhere you go, you take yourself. So that was what it was like when I was a kid. It was a lot of violence, a lot of drug use, a lot of addiction I saw as a kid. And I didn't even know what really drugs were until I got to about 12 years old. Then I really started to see the big picture with drugs and what it was doing to people. So
when you say at 12 years old, you started to understand more about drugs, let's dive into that a little bit more. To what extent, what was it like? Like, how were you introduced into drugs? Was it something that your parents were doing or you found like your friends were doing it, so on and so forth?
So when I lived in Brooklyn, after I moved out of my grandmother's house, we got our own place in another block. And that's where really I saw everything. You know, I had a group of neighborhood kids that ran on the block and we did all types of crazy stuff in that neighborhood. And I lived on the top floor of that house. It was a brownstone. But the downstairs part of the whole house was, you can get whatever you wanted there. So I would see people come and go and I would see people hang out all types of night. And there was a lot of shootouts in that time. You know, there were certain lines like drawn in the neighborhood. And if you cross those lines, there was a lot of violence. So, yeah, that's what I saw as a kid.
Did you start making like friends with those types of people? Like when did you start identifying with those types of people?
I was always scared of my mother.
Okay.
Because part of my story is there was a lot of physical abuse as a child. That's the way my mother was raised. And that's the way I was raised. What I got for corporal punishment back then is child abuse now. And that's what I probably knew, that if you got out of line, you got your ass whooped. And that's plain as I could put it. So I kind of identified with that also in the neighborhood. You got out of line with me, you got your ass whooped. And after a while, I stopped taking the ass whoopings. And that went hand in hand with the drugs and alcohol, because in that type of environment, you know, you see what goes on and it just becomes a part of everyday thing. But really, I didn't get into the drugs or selling drugs or anything like that because I was too afraid of my mother and what she was going to say. And I saw a lot of kids like, you know, wearing sneakers that were like really expensive. And you know, I did what I did. You know, I just hung out and I got offered drugs when I was, I think the youngest I was like sixth grade. I was in junior high school, and one of the kids had brought marijuana to school with him. And he rolled up a joint after school, and I was in junior high school. I went to one of the worst junior high schools in Brooklyn at the time, too. So it was gladiator school from the minute I opened my eyes to the minute I laid down at night. I was always fighting. I was fighting with myself. I was fighting with my mother. I was fighting with kids in the neighborhood. And, you know, I want to say that fight that was going on, it kind of perpetuated me to lean towards drugs because I was tired of that. So I wanted an escape from all the violence, you know?
That makes perfect sense. Ben, you were going to say something.
I just like painting a picture. Dude, sitting by Sean, man. Like, if he was on the corner, I'd probably try the next corner. I mean, just to give the listeners an idea, like, you know, he's a really nice guy, don't get me wrong, but like, dude, you got an intimidating look, and like, and I like painting that picture because it gives an idea, like, dude, I wouldn't mess with you. So when you talk about the violence and all that stuff, you know, and I'm sure we'll segue into it, like how much change can happen for an individual, but you look like a hard dude, man. I wouldn't mess with you.
So when did you start to, you said your mom got you out of that environment. When was that?
That was when I was like 14. I was in the ninth grade, and my mom decided that, you know, it was time to get out of Brooklyn, and we came down to Florida.
So you've been in Florida since you were 14?
Nah.
Okay.
I came down to Florida. I spent a couple years. I got into drugs and alcohol down here, and I always wanted to go back to New York. I was always back and forth, you know. From 15 on, I always went to New York for the summers. I spent 2 weeks with my cousin or one of my aunts, and I ran wild for the whole 2 weeks. I knew I had no curfew, no one to answer to, nothing, and I could do anything I wanted. Then to boot, when I came down here, when I was like 16, I got my license. So I went up to New York when I was like 17 with a license, which none of my friends had. And then I had access to a car. And, well, wherever you go, you take yourself with you.
So when did the drugs really start playing an effect on you in an addictive way? Because I know you're a plumber by trade. So you graduated high school, or did you graduate high school?
Yes.
Okay. And then from there, did you enter straight into the workforce, or what did that look like?
Well, I was already into drugs, but I was a full-blown addict, I want to say, at 18, probably even towards the latter year of my 17. And when it took me a while to get out of high school, I had to finish at night. I always went back and forth, and I was always changing my transcripts. I went to, like, at least 5 different high schools. And then when I finally got the diploma, because I had to get the diploma because my mother wanted it, you know, my mom wanted me to go to community college, and I told her, I said, save your money. I said, save your money because I'm not going to college. I said, all I'm going to do is party, and that's all my friends did. At the time, computer software programmer was the big thing, and everybody went to school, and the market got flooded. And everybody came out with these student loans, and I never did it. I went straight right into the workforce. I was doing excavation in Florida. I was always a heavy machine operator. I like driving. Anything I could with 4 wheels, I could drive it. Even to this day, I drove front end loaders. I drove forklifts. I used to break rock in the sun with a 90-pound jackhammer, and I'm only 120 pounds at the time. So, yeah.
You put on a few lbs.
Yeah.
Just a few.
So, when did you get into the plumbing?
I got into the plumbing when I went back up to New York when I was 22.
Okay.
My family's was heavy into the plumbing industry, and I was told you can make a good living, so I got in.
So walk us through that. Basically, what I want to talk about here is you going into the workforce, becoming, getting into the plumbing industry, and you were obviously in the union and had a very good job, very good income. What was your drug addiction like throughout that whole process? And that you were, I mean, you were a plumber for what, 20 years almost?
Yeah. I got into the apprenticeship when I was 22. I had a full blown drug habit. It was a full blown alcoholic. Anything that would get me out of myself, I loved. You know, with unions, they have a certain traditions, and one of the traditions was if you were an apprentice, you didn't pay at the bar. So for 5 years, I didn't pay for alcohol if there was mechanics with me. I would literally go on Thursday with all the journeymen, and that was the deal. Thursday at lunch, we'd cash our checks, we'd go to the bar, and I drank for free. And then I'd go home and have my own party. So that's probably about, I would say now you're putting me at 28, 29. And through those years of my 20s, I don't think I had a sober breath. There wasn't too many times. I saw 9/11 happen. That was a very bad time in New York. I had to get out of New York for a while. My drug and alcohol addiction was very, very bad. I was not employable at the time. I winded up in my father's house in California, sitting on the beach, getting drunk every day, waiting for the world to end. And it never happened.
Where'd you go from there?
After I decided that the world wasn't going to end, I came back to New York and I got back into trades, and I did some more plumbing and I burned some more bridges along the way. Now you put me at 33, and I always knew rehab was on the back burner, and it was always like a thing. When I have some time, I'll go. You know, that's what I always told my father. When I have some time, I'll go. Yeah, I think I'm going to go to rehab this year. Oh, wait, you know, Super Bowl's coming up, or my birthday, you know. And by this time, my father was, he had at least 10 years of sobriety, or probably almost leaning towards 20. So I winded up checking into rehab at 33. I found myself on a park bench in the Bronx at 7 o'clock in the morning. And prior to that morning, I had got 12-stepped on a construction site by my deputy foreman. And he asked me one simple question. Do you know the definition of insanity? And I said, no. And, you know, I knew he was in recovery, but to me, I thought he was in a bad car accident. So when he asked me that line, the light bulb went off, and he told me, doing the same thing over and over and expecting different results. And from that day on, my life changed. That next week, I had literally, you know, probably exhausted every favor that I could, and I burnt every bridge. So, you know, the walls had got really, like, closed in on me. There was nowhere else to go. And I was just tired of the way I was living. You know, I had lived with family members. I was doing the couch surfing thing for a while. And I did well as a plumber. And I could not put it together why my life was so messed up.
So you entered into treatment at 33 for the first time?
Yes, sir.
And what was that experience like for you?
It was the best 28 days of my life.
Okay. Where did you go?
I went to Clearbrook in Pennsylvania.
Okay.
I had went and I'd never been to treatment, and at the time I was living in Pennsylvania, so it was hard. You know, that morning, I'll never forget, I woke up and I knew I was going. I drew the shades up and I looked at the sun rise, and I kind of knew things were going to be different. I didn't know how. I was living in my uncle's house in Pennsylvania at the time, and it was not too far from the rehab, as God would have it, or my higher power, or whatever you want to call them. So when they sent the van, it was hard. It was hard. You know, admitting defeat. I got in this van. There's a friend, now friend of mine, who I'm still in contact with. And for the first 5 days, I was an emotional basket case. You know, I had never been to treatment. I'd never been really out of the city. I was taken completely out of my comfort zone. All I remember for the first 5 days is seeing all these triangles everywhere. And then I started to put it together that, you know, the deputy foreman, he had a triangle medallion on his neck. And so, like, in my mind, I was out of my, I thought I was going crazy. I was like, all these people with triangles are trying to kidnap me and wash my brain. And you know what? All I kept seeing was these 12 steps everywhere, these 12 steps. And, you know, you have to do the 12 steps. And it was just meetings and cigarettes and meetings. And I made some friends in there, and I shedded a lot of tears. And it was probably one of the first time I had heard in a long time from my father that he was proud of me. I was sitting in my therapist's office, or my counselor's office, and he said, "Hold on, I got a voicemail." And he played the voicemail, and it was my father. And I sat there and I listened to it, and he wanted the counselor to call him, so I just played the quiet role. He says, "Hold on, I'm gonna call your father." So he calls my father, and he puts it on speakerphone in front of me. And he goes, you know, this is so-and-so, I'm Sean's father, and blah, blah, blah. And he goes, "Yeah, you know, I heard he's getting out soon, and I just don't want him dictating his own recovery." And you know, the counselor told him, he was like, "No, he's doing really good in here, and, you know, he's participating in groups, and, you know, he's got a job in here, and he's doing, you know, cooperating and everything." And my father was like, "If you can you keep him in there for 90 days? Like, don't let him out." And I was like, "What the hell is he doing?" You know? And then he was like, no, he's doing good. And he told the counselor, he was like, "Tell my son I'm proud of him." And he hung up the phone. And I had not heard that in, like, years. And things started to happen when I was in that rehab. You know, I had quit my job to get my last paycheck. The foreman put me on medical leave, or he just didn't take me off payroll. I talked to the foreman who got me into treatment and everything, and I thanked him, and he said, "Don't worry about it. When you get out, your job is waiting for you." One thing about alcoholics and addicts, especially in the trades, we're really good workers when we put our mind to it. And I made that company a lot of money. Especially when I got out, because, you know, I had a new fire for life. And, you know, treatment up there was, it was wild, because I watched them build a dorm from the ground up. Every morning I watched them. And I saw these people working, and they were all having fun and laughing. And they were construction workers like me, but only in the mountains. And I said to myself, I said, you know, whatever happens when I get out of here, I want to be that guy. Like, I want to be happy to go to work. I want to be a productive member of society. I want to be a good worker. And it was definitely probably one of the best times of my life. I wanted to leave. Within 10 days, I wanted to leave. I'm not going to sit here and lie. But I'm so happy that I stayed.
So after you left there, though, because I'm just doing the math, you didn't stay sober. Or did you?
I got 5 years out of the first time I went to rehab.
Okay.
My life got really full, like everything else in recovery. And I put things in front of my recovery. And I got injured on a Sunday, and I went to the hospital, and they had to reattach a tendon. I got caught. It was a freak accident. and they put things in my surgery that they shouldn't have, and it kind of woke up the beast. I wasn't making meetings. I had 5 years. I was good, and I got what I got. And then I went out for a year and change. And the funny thing is that when you're in recovery for so long and then you go out, it's like going from light to dark, like really dark, really quick. And I didn't like it. And one of the things about this program is your sponsor, if he's a good sponsor, he never stops being your sponsor. And I remember one of the last days before I went back into rehab, I saw him with one of my friends on the street, and they were laughing and having a good time. And I just, you know, I was working in car service, like Uber in the Bronx, but it was a private livery service. And, you know, I thought it was a good idea to drive drunk and get high and drive people around. Because, you know, as most of us know, you know, in recovery, it's not so much the drugs and alcohol, it's the people, places, and things that come with it. And it was the full gambit. And I was out for a little bit. I tried to go to rehab. And the second time, I went in for a little bit. And I just walked out within 10 days. I walked out of that rehab within 5 days. I cracked a beer right in the parking lot, went back to my old thing. Then I decided I'd get in my truck and drive across America and go back to Dad's house. I got 90 days out of that one, came back to New York, fell off. And then this last time, I was just tired. I was tired of just running around, you know, the freaking vicious cycle. And in those 5 years, I sponsored a guy. I sponsored a bunch of guys. I had the privilege of sponsoring some guys. And one of those guys came back and 12-stepped me in my own house. And that's why I'm sitting here today. I always told him, never forget where you come from, and you never have to go back. And I remember him telling me that day in my own house, in my own living room. He says, you know, you always told me don't forget where you come from. Well, I never forgot. And here I am. I can't even sit in your own house. Look at this apartment. And, you know, it was a full debauchery. And he had to leave, and it broke my heart. And then that Saturday, I walked into a meeting, and his mother was getting, it was her anniversary, and she asked him to speak for him. And I was sitting there, and he did everything for me that I did for him in the beginning. Come on, sit down. And he handed me a cup of coffee, and he was like, it's going to be all right. And I couldn't wrap my head around how you go from 5 days to not getting past Friday night, 5 years to not getting past Friday night. And then he got up on the stage, and he said, you know, his name. And he was like, the only reason why I'm sober today is that man back there. And I was done. I was like, I'm going back. I can't do this no more. And I went back. I went back to Clearbrook, and I had no medical insurance. And like some good programs, they scholarship me. I had 2 weeks to get it done. That's what they gave me. They said, all right, you're alumni, 2 weeks. And I went in there. The first couple of days was rough, but, you know, I got the engine firing again. And by the time I came out, I had like half of my full sobriety going. Like, I was at half speed. I was still mocus, mine out of focus, but it was what I needed at the time. And it's always the guys that you'd least expected that tell you what you need to hear. We went out one night, and it was a meeting that they took us out of the rehab for. And I was beating myself up about having 5 years and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, it was the driver of the van. He pulls me in the front seat. He goes, he gives me a cigarette and he goes, he lights my cigarette for me. He goes, I heard your share in the meeting and, you didn't lose your sobriety. You just changed the date. And that's what I needed to hear.
So every now and again, we do these podcasts and like, you just kind of sit back and listen and forget that we're even recording. And this is what just happened for me. So, you know, we've been recording now for a half hour and your story is the type that you can just sit back and listen to and hear the solution in it. You know, a lot of times when we record, it's like, you know, a lot of times people want to talk about war stories and they want to qualify themselves and talk about how bad they were and so on and so forth. Your story is very solution focused. And your emphasis on sponsorship and stuff like that is huge. And I know Ben's chomping at the bit because this is something that rings very dear to Ben, with sponsorship. It has helps a lot of guys too. So Ben, I want to hear from you based off of what he just said. What's going on in your head right now?
The first thing that jumped out to me was probably 10 minutes ago when he, mentioned his first time in treatment and 10 days in, something like 5-10 days in, he was talking about a lot of tears were shed. Number one, I want to say we don't get sober by being tough guys. Like, and I like throwing that out there, man, because growing up as a dude on this planet in the US of A, like, I'm taught, man, I'm supposed to be a badass, right? Like, men take care of their problems, they handle them. But I ended up having to find out the hard way that one of the key steps to getting sober is becoming transparent, being vulnerable, putting yourself out there, and not being afraid to sit in a group and shed some tears. Because, dude, I can't tell you like how freeing that is. Because the next time you go in, you've already cried in front of a bunch of people. What for the rest of treatment? Like, what more could go worse than that? You know, like, and just the ability to throw yourself in, but also the sponsorship thing. I love that he touched on the fact, what'd you say? You don't lose your sobriety, you change the date. Is that what it was? On that, you know, I've seen a lot of people go back out after having years of sobriety. You know, there's been some people that have been a huge part of my own recovery that have gone back out. And you always see the same thing where, you know, it's the old cliche, like the 12 step programs, AA, NA, they give you a life that takes you out of AA or whatever 12-step program you're in. And basically speaking, like, you know, when I have guys that have gone back out, like, you know, the beautiful thing is Tom saying that you could just sit back and listen. What I'm hearing is, at the end of the day, like, some people have to have these experiences. And the nice thing is that Sean's willing to share on that and let people know that have gone back out. You're not like, in my book, dude, we're put on a path. And obviously his path involved a relapse after 5 years. But how many people is he going to be able to help with that? You know, and to have a sponsee that he did work with at first, like, Sean put himself out there. It's funny how the role reversal happened, but at the end of the day, Sean did the work up front. He just cashed it in later, if that makes sense. You know, with his sponsee coming around and you know, you never know who's going to affect you. You never know. At the end of the day, like, I sit down with my sponsees, man. I got a couple of sponsees who have several years, and we joke back and forth, like, who's sponsoring who here? You know, because that's really what it is. I don't believe in putting sponsors up on a pedestal, you know, because at the end of the day, man, like, my sponsees do me, honestly, more good than I probably do them. At least that's how I feel, you know, but we have to give ourselves credit for doing the work, and that foundation is there. And you know, you have to learn from that stuff. Tom hit it home for me. Like, I'm huge on the sponsorship thing, dude. And being vulnerable and at least being 110% honest with a few people in your life about everything that you suck at, you know? Sometimes I bounce stuff off of Tom. What I did last week. I won't talk about it on here because I'll keep that one between us. But I was like, dude, I got to wrap myself out on something, dude, you know, when things are bothering me.
No, he didn't relapse. We're just throwing that.
Tom was looking at me like I relapsed. He's like, what'd you do, dude? Did you eat an edible?
Yeah. I'm like, did you eat kratom or did you do kratom or something? I was getting nervous. I'm like, oh no. So, all right. So here we are now. You are just celebrating 4 years yesterday, right?
Yes, sir.
Congratulations, dude.
Congrats.
You work in the field now. It's comparing apples to oranges now. You went from a union plumber in the grind every day, making big bucks. Yeah, I mean, and the last time we met, Sean was telling us about the amount of money and stuff he was making and doing union plumbing. And I mean, it's crazy. And I always knew, like, but you know, it's ball breaking work, of course, and you deserve every penny of it. But every penny of it was going towards your drugs and alcohol, I assume. And here we are, fast forward to today. I mean, I don't know what you make today, but I'm willing to bet it's not as much as what you were making doing plumbing. But you're in the solution. You know, yeah. You get to help people, and it's a different type of payment, you know, and I think that's the cool thing. So let's touch a little bit about how you got involved in the field, what got you into this, like, because now you're essentially responsible for getting people into detox. You know, that are out, you know, running and gunning, shooting dope today, and you get them in detox tomorrow. How'd you get into that?
So while I was in the union, when I was still turning wrenches, wow, it seems like a lifetime ago. I met a bunch of guys, and you know, the way I was brought in the program was, you know, you don't just walk away when you get sober and life is good. You get back in the trenches, you grab a gun, and you help the guy who's still suffering. And along the way, I saw a bunch of guys that were still, you know, in the grips of addiction. And unbeknownst to me, my old sponsor put me in touch with this guy who's now my best friend and probably my rabbit's foot. We bounce things off of each other all the time. We have our arguments, our spats, but he's my best friend. Like, he's my partner, my life partner, whatever you want to call him. And I helped him get sober. I sent him down here one time, and he went to this place called The Haven Detox and TRT. And he told me about the great experience that he had. And I sent another guy or two down there, and you know, this is when I was still, you know, turning wrenches. And when I got down here, I was you know, turning wrenches, and you know, I guess God would have it, or my higher power put me in touch with certain people, and they asked me to take this position. I took a tour, and they offered me a job. And you know, at 43 years old, I'm pretty beat up from the industry. And I remember a long time ago, I forget where it was. I think it was in Graymore. I went one time. Graymore is another facility in upstate New York that's ran by the Franciscan monks. They call it the Holy Mountain. And one of the guys came in, and he said, you know, how he had this job that yielded him this whole life of wealth and everything, and he was never happy. And he says, the only time I was really happy was when I was helping other guys. He says, the money wasn't as great, but the reward was the currency of people and the friendships he made and the camaraderie. And, you know, I like that. You know, you call me a quack, a spoof, or whatever, but I'm a people person, always have been, always will. And I sent one of my friends down here, and he told me what was going on down here with construction. I was tired of New York, the hustle and bustle, and I was tired of the cold. You know, I was working on the side of bridges, 20 below, and you wake up at single digits, and you got to get on the train at 4 o'clock in the morning. And I was like, watching all these old timers die that brought me into the business, literally die at the bar. And they always talk about how when they make it to Florida, they're going to buy a boat and a house, and they never make it. So I said, you know what? Maybe it's time for a career change. And I came down here, and you know what? I haven't looked back. And that's the good thing about sobriety is, like, no matter where you go, you don't have to be alone. I got connected down here. I met some people. I go to meetings. I left my old home group. I'm still in touch with those people. COVID has brought those people back in my life because I made Zoom meetings with them. And, you know, where I'm at in life now, you know, I used to hear this all the time in meetings. And even one guy even said it to me. AA is the best thing that ever happened to me. And I used to grind my teeth when I would hear that crap. You know what? AA is the best thing that ever happened to me. I have a life beyond my wildest dreams, and it's not about the material things. It's just a sense of self. When I wake up in the morning, I know where my shoes are. I know where my car is. I know what I got to do. Most of my days are planned out. Everybody looks at me, and they know I'm a straight shooter, that I haven't been out all night partying or, you know. I know where my car is today, and that's a big deal for me because there was a lot of nights I didn't know where my car was.
So I'm glad we kind of touched on the union thing. If you don't mind, I'd like to ask you, like, your experience. And I mean, at this point, I guess professional and personal opinion on the union stuff. I'm from South Florida. We never had unions down here. I was a bartender, personal trainer. I mean, the most manual labor I ever did was working for a moving company. But what I look at a lot of our clients that come into treatment, and in my head, I kind of keep a tally. And just to be frank, today we got a guy, part of a union, leaving treatment AMA because it's so important to get back to the union. Let me ask you, like, because this is my impression. So oftentimes, we do get a lot of union workers down here, whether it's coal mining, steel workers, plumbers, etc., electricians from the Northeast and whatever. They get to treatment, and I feel like my perspective, and this is why I'm asking, because I'd like you to correct me if I'm wrong, but the union takes such good care of them that it's nearly enabling, and they end up a lot of times that all they focus on when they're in treatment is, I need to get back to the union. I need to look good for the union. It's all about the union. And then they go back and they fall right back off. This is what I've seen in my experience. I just feel like a lot of times the recovery aspect doesn't get put first. I don't know. It's more of an open-ended question, if you could.
So, unions are great. I wouldn't be sitting in this chair if it wasn't for certain people in my local. I can't sit here and discredit any unions, but the thing with unions is you get really wrapped up in the brotherhood. You really do. And it's the life, you know. I would say my plumbing prime, I loved it. I love getting up every day, getting on the train, going to work. When I'd get off, I'd be covered in an inch of concrete dust. I had a nice white shirt, my combed hair, and a pocket full of money, and I could do anything I wanted in that city. And I knew it. I was a king. But it gets old after a while, and you know, some people, they don't know how to distinguish the life from the recovery. You get caught up in the whole job site atmosphere, and there's no rules really on, well, when I was coming in, there was no rules. Now it's kind of changed. It clamped down on safety and everything else. But, you know, it's a young man's game. It really is. And, you know, until certain guys wake up and they realize that, you know what, some of your better years you gave to the union, and now you're a little older, and what have you got to show for it? A bunch of bar stories and pay stubs? Because that was the wake-up call for me. When I was in that basement that one time, and I had a milk crate full of pay stubs and no furniture. So it gets addicting, the lifestyle, the camaraderie, the everything, you know, that goes with it. But yeah, the union does take very good care of their workers.
See, now that makes sense to me when you talk about it as like a brotherhood. Like now I'm starting to put the puzzle pieces together. Obviously, there's people in recovery in unions. I mean, you mentioned the guy in your story with the triangle necklace. Do you think that there's a lot of guys in recovery within the union, or is drugs and alcohol a big part of the culture, or is it what you choose to see when you're in it?
It's funny that you should mention that. When I got out of treatment that first time, unbeknownst to me, I was on a job in the Bronx. It was 180 plumbers. And we were building a water filtration plant. It was basically like a city block underneath the ground, underneath the golf course, a little miniature city inside of a borough in New York. And there was a whole tribe of sober guys on that job. And when I came out of treatment, everybody was introduced. Everybody introduced themselves to me, and they made themselves known, and they took care of the newcomer. And that's part of being in the union, too, is that it could go either way. It could go either really good for you, or it could go really bad for you. It depends who you choose to keep company with. I mean, I got union brothers today that I'm still in touch with, that they're lifelong friends. I could call at 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the morning. This is what's happening with me. I haven't turned a wrench with those guys in years, but they'll be with me to my dying day. I wouldn't be in this chair if it wasn't for them. I mean, I came out and I had like certified tough guys talking to me about their feelings and how their life has changed and what you need to change. And I am forever eternally indebted to those people, because had it not been for them, I would not be here. I did not know how to live life. And those guys taught me how to live life. So it could go either way. It depends who you choose to keep company with, you know?
So what's your plans moving forward? I mean, like, do you see yourself just staying in this? Or do you have any plans moving forward? Are you going to stay in Florida? You want to go back to New York? What is it that you aspire to do moving forward?
I just keep coming back every day. I take it as it comes. I've been a couple places. I'm not afraid to move. So I don't really have a plan, but I like not having a plan, if that makes any sense. Because anytime I kind of wake up, there's an old joke I heard. You want to make your higher power laugh? Wake up and tell him what you're going to do today. Because I can tell you what I want to do. That don't mean it's going to happen. And that's probably something that should be said to a lot of newcomers. You know, just because you get clean or you get sober, life isn't going to go always the way you want it to. I mean, if in my eyes, when I got a rehab, oh, great. You know what? I'm clean now. I'll just turn wrenches till I can retire and I'm done. And you know what? You get clean and you kind of like, you get sober and the light clicks on, and maybe this life wasn't meant for me. Like, maybe this is just the start. You know, since I've gotten sober, this program has just taken me in different directions, literally. I like where it's going now. I like being in the treatment field. I like, you know, helping people, you know. I like my mess being the message. But I am not responsible for the results.
Dude, I like that. I like my mess being the message. I had never heard that before. It's a cool saying.
Yeah, I heard that in this field. This lady I'm friends with told me that, one of the other outreach coordinators. She said, let your mess be the message. I was like, I'm coining that. That's mine.
Dude, we rarely have any original material. Everything that I say, I'm like a parrot, dude. I heard from somewhere else.
So before we wrap up, what do you tell somebody that is just on the fence? They don't know what to do. It's either an addict themselves or it's a loved one of somebody that, say they have a son, they have a Sean in their life, and they're like, this dude is gonzo. I don't know what to do. I don't know where to begin. What advice do you have for that person? Just the same as what advice do you have for the other Shauns out there in the world that really feel hopeless and they don't know where to turn or what to do?
This old timer that I came into the program, and he always told me, give yourself a break today. And that's what I try to do. And that's what I would say to the guy, give yourself a break. Because, I mean, what's going on out there is biblical. And if people don't see it, I don't know what to tell you. But, I mean, as far as I would, you know, you could drop pamphlets and you can put them in touch with someone, you know, you can take them to a meeting. You can ask an interventionist to come in, you know, kind of guide them. But I tell you, my father always tried to force sobriety on me, and it never worked. It never worked. It, for some reason or another, it sounds like blah, blah, blah when it comes from your parents or a loved one. I would say, honestly, you just got to pray for them at this point. Because I know for many nights my mother prayed for me. And even my grandmother. And that's probably why I'm protected today, all those prayers.
That's good. I like that. Ben, any final thoughts?
Nah, I could keep going for days on so much of what he touched on, dude. Thank you for everything that you shared, man. There's a lot of really good lessons there.
Yeah, man. Thanks for coming on. Congratulations again on 4 years. It's awesome. Thanks for coming on the show. I know a lot of people are going to get a lot out of this. In the end, you know, I think the main message that you portrayed is like, everybody's circumstances are different, but we're all cut from the same cloth. You're a union plumber. I worked on cars. Ben was a personal trainer, shot dope in the locker room before he'd go out and personal train people, you know? But in the end, we're all in recovery. We're all working towards to just better ourselves and to be better productive humans and so on and so forth. And, you know, I think you're an asset to many people. And again, congratulations on the 4 years. So that is it for this episode of Real Recovery Talk. Thank you for listening. Again, don't forget to go to realrecoverytalk.com. This episode is episode 157. So take a listen to all of the episodes. And if you have any questions, comments, or concerns, feel free to reach out. That is it. We will see y'all later.
You've been listening to Real Recovery Talk with Tom Conrad. If you'd like to have a confidential conversation about your specific situation, give Tom a call on his direct line at 561-220-7163. Or if you'd prefer, you can chat with Tom live at realrecoverytalk.com. As always, if this show is a benefit to you, please give it a 5-star rating and review in Apple Podcasts, Google Play Music, or wherever you discover your favorite podcasts. Thank you for being part of our mission to bring hope and healing to our loved ones struggling with addiction, as well as wisdom and comfort to those of us around them.